Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Over the past 40 years, the efforts by the Cherokee freedmen to gain full tribal rights in the Cherokee Nation has by turn burned and simmered. After a series of high-profile events over the last decade, including a tribal referendum and a series of court cases in the Cherokee court system, that issue is now in the federal court system. At the heart of the conflict are questions on what it means to be a member of the Cherokee Nation. Is it a matter of nationality and political determination, or over Indianness, which is a question of race? Well, my guest today delves into these complex questions, which affects not only the Cherokee, but the freedmen of the other four southern removed tribes that settled in Indian Territory, the five civilized tribes, if you will. Hannibal Johnson is a Tulsa attorney and human rights activist. He's written a history of the interwoven story of these tribes, their former African-American slaves and freedmen, and their relationship through history and how it has evolved over time. The name of the book is Apartheid in Indian Country, Seeing Red Over Black Disenfranchisement. While focusing on the Cherokee freedmen issue, the book also addresses freedmen issues in the Creek, Choctaw, Seminole, and Chickasaw nations as well. In fact, the book is overall an interesting history about race in Indian Territory, Oklahoma Territory, and the early state of Oklahoma. He'll be speaking about the book and signing the book this Saturday from 1 to 3 at Rudisill Library, and he joins us as our guest today, Hannibal Johnson, here on Studio Tulsa. Hannibal Johnson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Your new book, Apartheid in Indian Country, looks at the freedmen issue, which has been simmering and percolating here in Oklahoma over the, well, really for the last 40 years, but certainly over the last 15 years. It has ebbed and flowed with the various court cases that have gone on. What interests you in writing about this?
Well, I'm a big fan of kind of a people's history approach. So sharing an additional perspective on our history that's not often told and not included in the history books is what really interested me. The story of the freedmen is not something I grew up knowing anything about. I had no idea who the freedmen were, or that the relationship between African Americans and Native Americans was so strong and so long, historically speaking.
How long does that shared history go back?
Depending on whom you ask, it goes back to the 1400s, 1500s. I mean, it goes way, way back. A lot of interaction, intermingling, intermarriage, and most people don't realize that the so-called five civilized tribes, they were all slaveholders. Mm-hmm. I think people just don't know.
Well, they were all southern tribes.
They were all tribes that were relocated here to Oklahoma from the southeastern United States, and they were civilized precisely because they had adopted white ways. One of the white ways of the southeast was the enslavement of people of African ancestry.
And landowners.
And right, absolutely.
So, and that necessitated in that particular part of the country the owning of African Americans. So in the Trail of Tears, slaves, African Americans moved west with their Native American masters?
Absolutely. And not all the people of African ancestry who migrated with the five tribes on the Trail of Tears were enslaved. Some were free persons living among the tribes. I include in the book a quote from the late, great Wilma Mankiller, who talks about, you know, what a shame it is that people don't fully appreciate that along the Trail of Tears were people of African ancestry right along with the Native Americans.
Mm. So as you began getting into the story, where did you begin? Because, I mean, this is still a very contentious issue within the Cherokee tribe, within many segments of eastern Oklahoma, because this affects all five civilized tribes to an extent, with the exception of maybe the Chickasaws.
Absolutely. So I began really with talking with and to people who had a more direct connection than I. For example, Marilyn Van out of Oklahoma City has been a real advocate for freedmen rights.
And she's been a litigant in federal.
Absolutely. She's got a case pending in Washington, D.C. in federal court right now. The late Bob Littlejohn was very much interested in his Creek ancestry and the plight of the freedmen within the Creek Nation. Eli Grayson, who lives in Southern California recently, has another home here, very active in the Creek Nation. So a lot of individuals with whom I was able to speak and get information and become more interested. So this really is a culmination of about a five-year process for me.
Yeah. You went through the process. You talked to ancestors of the freedmen, and you also talked to tribal officials, too, former tribal officials. Ross Swimmer, I think you interviewed.
I did.
And Ross Swimmer was really where the freedmen really sort of came back into the news, right? Because the Cherokee government was reorganized about the time he became principal chief or somewhere?
It started out with really kind of what may seem to be benign registration rules that required a CDIB card, certificate of degree of Indian blood card and all that. Unfortunately, those cards are tied to registration on the Dawes rolls. The Dawes rolls were compiled in the early 20th century by white Dawes officials who registered people on one of two rolls, the blood rolls for people whom they perceived to be Indian, and the freedman roll for those people whom they perceived to be of African ancestry, of any African ancestry. The problem is, if you wound up on the freedman roll, they didn't record your blood quantum, your Native American degree of blood, if you had any. Mm-hmm. So even though some of the freedmen actually have Indian blood, as we'd say, it's not recorded on the freedman roll. It might be recorded on some other document that the tribe maintained, but it's not on that roll. So the fact that the CDIB card is tied to that is problematic because they don't get access to services, et cetera.
Right. And what also exacerbated this was the fact that the tribes basically challenged that blood requirement for receiving federal services, right?
Right, right.
And this is where it becomes a big issue because now if blood quantity, which was not noted on the Dawes roll, is not recorded, then all of a sudden freedmen have the right to get these services as official members of the tribe under certain treaties.
Right. It's sort of really complex and messy. This really stems back to the Civil War, as many things in America do. The five tribes all officially aligned themselves with the Confederacy during the Civil War, even though Native Americans fought on both sides, on both the Confederate side and the Union side. Well, guess what? The Union won that war. And so as a result, the federal government negotiated treaties with the five tribes. The tribes, with the exception of the Chickasaws, agreed in those treaties in 1866, negotiated in my hometown of Fort Smith, Arkansas. Uh-huh. They agreed to adopt their freedmen, people of African ancestry who had been enslaved. Chickasaws, again, did not so agree in these treaties. And so that really is the primary basis for the claims of the freedmen to tribal citizenship. And the tribes, for the most part, had accorded them those citizenship rights all throughout the decades until relatively recently, the early 80s for the most part.
And what facilitated that change? Was it the fact that there were more services available or the fact that there's now more money in the tribes with gaming and the like? Has this had a role?
I think some of the freedmen would say all of the above,
yeah.
Plus politics. Many of the freedmen believe that their political motivations for trying to exclude the freedmen, because the freedmen at one point were aligned with a particular candidate. This is all, you know, sort of speculative, but certainly there are freedmen who believe that. There are also freedmen who believe that some of the tribal officials are interested in excluding them now that the tribes are becoming more wealthy through tobacco smoke shops, et cetera, through gaming and so forth. Even though tribes like the Cherokees, I mean, they don't get per capita distributions. The wealth goes back into the nation, theoretically.
Yeah. Well, as you began investigating, I assume you began with the Cherokee story. And let's before we actually get into some of the other areas of the book, because really it's almost a history of race in Oklahoma, early Oklahoma.
It is.
Yeah. But where does the legal issues stand regarding the Cherokees? I understand there are two court cases. You outline in the book the numerous court cases. I mean, this has already gone to the U.S. District Court of Appeals on certain issues surrounding the freedmen. And basically, they've upheld those particular cases upheld tribal sovereignty as far as deciding who are members and who aren't.
Well, there are two cases that are pending right now. One is the Nash case here in Tulsa in federal court. And it's a case brought by the Cherokee Nation itself against some individual freedmen. In the bringing of that case, the Cherokee Nation, by definition, waives its sovereign immunity to suit, because it filed the suit.
Right.
The other case is pending in federal court in Washington, D.C. It's a case brought by some freedmen, including Marilyn Vann, against the Cherokee Nation through officials of the nation, tribal chief, who was Chad Smith at the time the suit was filed, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the Cherokee Nation itself as an entity can't be sued, but tribal officials in their individual capacities can be sued, and that's the basis of that suit. These suits might be consolidated at some point.
Now, what are each side alleging in the two suits? What is the Cherokee Nation alleging in the suit here in Tulsa?
The Cherokee Nation's position has been essentially that it's a separate sovereign, and it has the sovereign prerogative to decide who its citizens are. Mm-hmm. The freedmen essentially argue there was a treaty executed in 1866. It has not been disavowed by Congress. It's still valid. It accords the freedmen citizenship rights.
My guest today is Hannibal Johnson. He's an attorney and human rights activist. His latest book is titled Apartheid in Indian Country, Seeing Red Over Black Disenfranchisement. And he'll be signing the book this Saturday from 1 to 3 at Rudisill Library and doing a short presentation about what he's learned. And as I mentioned earlier, this is really a history of race in Oklahoma. And some of the most interesting part of our history is what's not taught. And this story of race goes hand in hand with the creation of, you know, Indian Territory, Oklahoma Territory, and when these two territories merged to become a state.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the demographics in Oklahoma, just prior to statehood around 1890 in Indian Territory, the overwhelming majority is composed of Native Americans, then African Americans constitute the next largest segment of the population, and then whites. But if you look at the demographics in 1910, some 20 years later, it's something like 85% white. The next largest group is African Americans, and then slightly behind that group is Native Americans. It's a total flip of the population statistics and the demographics. The interesting thing about Oklahoma history is the confluence of those three demographic groups, African Americans, Native Americans, and European Americans, and their interactions one with another. I think of the quote by, or the paraphrase by Dr. Maya Angelou, our history, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, it need not be lived again. We can't change what's happened in our past, but we have to acknowledge it, and we have to sort of address it in the present for the sake of the future. That's my philosophy.
Yeah, as I was reading through the book, I kept thinking of this. There's a, I think it's Pike County, Ohio, and it is a small rural county in southern Ohio. It has a large African-American population, but the whole thing is there's been so much intermarriage that, you know, people are sort of, they don't know whether they're white, they're black, they're somewhere in between. And this article that I was reading was called Black As You Want to Be. And it's about really this colorblind society that's taking hold in this little microcosm here in the United States. And I kept thinking about this because this is all about who am I, who do I identify with? And that seems to be getting to where that is slowly, maybe it will take another couple generations where that's not going to be an issue.
Well, that's very interesting because an integral part of Oklahoma history has been the imposition of the rule of hypodescent. And that is, if you had any African ancestry, that was a disabling factor for you. Even in terms of our Constitution, when we became a state in 1907, you know, the first legislation was Senate Bill No. 1, segregated facilities based on the rule of hypodescent. So Native Americans were essentially honorary whites for purposes of Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. So we have this really, really ugly history that will take a while, I believe, to overcome if we're ever to become anything approaching a colorblind society.
Yeah. Well, as you got into the book, one of the things you did is you outlined the Cherokee history, but you outlined the other tribes. Was that, I mean, I think we've heard a little bit about the Creek freedmen, but not nearly to the extent of the Cherokee freedmen. But as you began learning about all the civilized tribes, so-called five civilized tribes, they all have these freedmen issues to one extent or another.
They do. The focus is slightly skewed toward the Cherokee Nation because that's the flashpoint right now in the controversy over the freedmen. But the debate has raged in the other tribes as well. In the Seminole tribe, there's actually been litigation. You may recall the litigation in the late 90s where the Seminoles, Congress really sort of said, you know, we're going to withhold funding from you unless you affirm the rights of your freedmen. So there were several Seminole cases in federal court. Seminoles ended up accepting their freedmen as citizens. There's still some controversies. But that was sort of resolved. But the same issue sort of reared its ugly head in the context of other tribes later. One interesting tidbit about the Chickasaws. The Chickasaws were the one tribe among the five civilized tribes that did not agree to accept their freedmen as citizens. As a result, the Chickasaw freedmen were, for all intents and purposes, people without a nation for about 50 years. Right, because they weren't citizens of,
but they were allowed to stay in the Chickasaw Nation.
Right,
this is when they were in territory status.
Right, they weren't citizens of the tribe, but they weren't citizens of the United States either at that point. So there are people without a nation. The other interesting thing about the Chickasaw is the fact that they did not adopt their freedmen. The Chickasaws had more freedmen than any of the other tribes, which says slavery was more prevalent in the Chickasaw Nation than any of the other tribes. And one of the issues historically is the fear of the Chickasaw Nation that were the freedmen granted citizenship, their numbers were such that they might be overwhelming.
They would be the majority
politically, right? because when the final Dawes Rolls were constructed in 1907, the freedmen among the Chickasaw Nation represented about, I think it's 42.5% of the nation, whereas in the Cherokee Nation, it was something like 12%.
Isn't that interesting?
So the politics of all this is really important, and it's important that we not lose sight of the political calculus that's going on in this debate.
What about the Choctaws and the Creeks?
Choctaws and the Creeks both had a fair number of freedmen. I believe the Creeks had over 20%, I believe, and the Choctaws as well. Maybe Choctaws, maybe 30%. And so there are a lot of commentators who talk about the institution of slavery and how it differed from tribe to tribe and how relationships, for example, in the Seminole Nation and the Creek Nation tended to be more favorable for the Africans who lived among them, even if they were enslaved.
And how would those relations, I mean, once emancipation came about, which did happen in what, for most of the tribes, I think in the case of the Cherokees, I think they emancipated in what, 1863?
Pre
the end of the war.
End of the war.
Yeah.
Right.
Did intermarriage enter into this after the war, post-war period? Yeah. And so that you could become a straight member of the tribe?
There were intermarriages, but a number of the tribes had really sort of strict black codes, which sort of restricted interactions or engagements with people of African ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And actually punished Native Americans for engaging with people of African ancestry. So it's like all of our history, it's sort of convoluted and it's tortured and it's troubling, but that's what makes it interesting, and that's also what makes it compelling from our point of view of trying to address it so that we can move forward together in the present and for the future.
Yeah. You mentioned that the relationship was a little bit different in the Creek tribe. Have they taken a different approach towards their freedmen today, or is this still maybe a nascent issue as opposed to, you know, something that's sort of at flashpoint like with the Cherokee Nation? Or mm-hmm. What are the status with the other two tribes?
Freedmen are not citizens because of these requirements with respect to showing an ancestor on the Dawes Rolls. And it's important to remember the role of economics in all this. The reason the Cherokee Nation case is playing out the way it is because we have some very strong advocates like Marilyn Vann, and we have some lawyers who are willing to devote their time without full compensation to pursue the matter as sort of devotion to principle. So it takes resources to press these legal cases, even if you are absolutely sure that you are in the right. So that's been absent in some of these other tribes, whereas in the Cherokee Nation, it's been possible.
Let's talk about you. I'm sure you talked to a number of Cherokee officials and former Cherokee officials. Can you talk about trying to get to the heart of their viewpoint of the matter and how they view the issue? How do they view the issue? Because for an outsider, it seems to be something harking back to an era that we don't want to remember, that, you know, it's about blood as sort of the determinant, even though it's not necessarily always about blood being the determinant.
Yeah, it's really troubling, I think, because it's 2013, and it seems to me that the invariable trend is toward inclusion, not exclusion. And when the group to be excluded appears to be being excluded on the basis of race, I think many people just find that patently offensive. So I think some people in the tribe would say, my guess is that they would say, well, it's important that we be assured that people who are citizens actually have a connection, a real connection to the tribe. Well, the problem is, in some tribes like the Cherokee Nation that have expanded greatly over the last few years, they've been welcoming of people with European ancestry and what have you that don't necessarily have cultural ties to the tribe. You don't have to demonstrate that, that you're culturally Indian to be a member of the tribe, whereas many of the freedmen actually are culturally Indian. They've engaged with the tribe. They participated in elections when they could before they were prohibited without denied access, essentially. Historically, look at the Creek Nation. A number of the interpreters for the Creek Nation in terms of working on negotiating the Treaty of 1866 were freedmen. They were black people. That's part of their history. Some of the tribal officials and tribal council members in the Creek Nation, they were people of African ancestry. So that cultural connection really is there. So the larger question is, what does it mean to be Indian?
And in this day and age, it means a tribe has sovereignty over those issues. And I think a lot of the tribal members would say, this is our decision. We decide it. And maybe not even the U.S. federal government, because we are an entity unto ourselves.
And the freedmen would say,
yeah,
that's all well and good. But you were also sovereign when you executed the treaty. Sovereign to sovereign. Tribe to federal government. Treaty is valid. Congress hasn't abrogated the treaty. You're bound by the treaty.
Are the Cherokee Nation making any sort of noise about that treaty being, you know, remember, this is right after the Civil War. This is during Reconstruction. A lot of decisions were made where it was like not necessarily the decision they would make, but they were a conquered entity. Was it any sort of discussion of that treaty being made under duress?
Absolutely. That's an argument that the Cherokee Nation has made. But think about it. What end-of-war treaty is not a treaty made under some duress? That's the nature of the beast, right? So
I think that's the sticking issue, though, because with the southern states, they had to accept the conditions to be, you know, as to be, again, a part of the United States. The tribes have, and it really probably wasn't manifested at its time because that sovereignty was not nearly as strong as it is today. And I think that's the sticking issue, is that if that was made under duress, does that really still count? Because we have our own sovereignty and should have had our own sovereignty under previous treaties prior to that. That's the legal issue, I guess, that will eventually be decided.
Well, I think the freedmen then could just point to the negotiators of, for example, the Cherokee negotiators of the treaty. These were very sophisticated, very well-educated people who I think the freedmen would say knew what they were doing. It was a bargain that they made, and the bargain continues.
We'll have to see. My guest today is Hannibal Johnson, a attorney and human rights activist, written a very fascinating book that tells, really, it's the history of race in Oklahoma, but it also concentrates on the issue of black freedmen within the five eastern tribes of Indian Territory, the five civilized tribes, if you will. It's titled Apartheid in Indian Country, Seeing Red Over Black Disenfranchisement. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, you in the book, you sort of look over the whole history regarding freedmen and all of the five tribes that were removed to eastern Oklahoma. You've looked at sort of the history of African-American relationships within Oklahoma Territory and within the beginning of the state. As these court cases, you know, right now, I think we're in a quiet time a little bit as these court cases are sort of making their way through the federal court system. What would be the outcome you'd like to see other than, you know, maybe seeing these treaty rights fulfilled in full, but beyond that, sort of the relationship between African Americans and Native Americans? They have this long shared history. You think, you know, you talk about this intertwined history that was always a part of these two groups. Do you think it will ever get back to something like that, where they're both living, working together, not really worried about who's a member of the tribe or not?
Well, the first step is just sort of acknowledging that the history is there. And I don't even think that's been done yet. I mean, I think many people, many Native Americans, many African Americans, are really ignorant of the shared relationship throughout history. So if the tribes could be of any assistance in disseminating information, historical information about the tribe's inclusivity in Oklahoma throughout their history, that would be most helpful. Some commentators have suggested, and I tend to agree, that it's important for the tribes to really think about what is a Native American, or what is an Indian, what makes an Indian, because the blood quantum route is perilous. I think if you take the blood quantum approach to Indianness to its extreme, the tribes are going to be obsolete at some point. Because as you referenced earlier, there's a great deal of intermarriage and so forth. And so there's a potential that the tribes will sort of blood quantum themselves out of existence if you take that notion of blood quantum to the extreme. So is it just blood quantum? Is it acculturation? Is it the embrace of tribal ways and customs? What is it that makes someone an Indian?
Well, this is one of the big stories, I think, involving all Indian tribes today, is the fact that in certain parts of the country, being an Indian, being, say, a Navajo, a Zuni, in many of the Western tribes, there is certain cultural expectation, there's a certain cultural way of living your life that is very different than a lot of other tribes further east, who have acculturated to the dominant culture over American history. And it's really interesting, because there are divisions even within Indian country over what it means to be an Indian.
It's a fascinating question. And I think about, what does it mean for me to be a black person? What does that mean? Does it mean anything particular? Is it about culture? Is it really about race? Well, race is only a social construct with very little meaning in the biological sense. So what is it to be an African-American person?
This might be one of the questions we confront really about racial relations in the 21st century. What does it mean to be any of these things that we check off on the census?
Right,
I'm pretty certain we'll have none of the above.
Right, absolutely.
Well, it's a really interesting book, Apartheid in Indian Country. Hannibal Johnson will be signing the book and talking about the book this Saturday at Rudisill Library. Hannibal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Hannibal Johnson is a local attorney, a writer, and a human rights activist, and the author of Apartheid in Indian Country, Seeing Red Over Black Disenfranchisement. He'll be speaking about the book and signing it this Saturday from 1 to 3 at the Rudisill North Regional Library at 1520 North Hartford. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.